Out of Chinese Alliance Church. We're right in the middle of a month focused on justice and mercy. And when it comes to that particular topic, you can't avoid the issue of human trafficking. I mean, just one of the greatest, you know, really injustices in our time that's been going on for quite a while. As I was preparing for this particular message, I was thinking, how am I really going to do this? I mean, I could talk about statistics about worldwide human trafficking. You know, $32 billion industry a year, makes it the second, highest grossing, criminal activity, the highest one being drug activity. And I was thinking, well, how's this really going to connect to us? And so I thought about how can we maybe learn more about the issue of human trafficking at home, you know, where we live. And so I started to search the internet, just human trafficking, you know, Seattle. That's what I did. And I started reading all of these articles of different cases that were happening in the Seattle metro area, Western Washington here. And as I was reading through the articles, there was one name and a soundbite that kept on coming up, and the name was Yiting Wu. So this Chinese name, right? And I was like, who is this Chinese person that I see in all of these articles? This person who's kicking butt. I mean, really, you know, are you putting people to jail? It's just really awesome. And I was like, I've got to meet this person. So I did a little bit of digging and did a lot of internet searches and stalking and things like that, and found out a little bit more about Yiting. I was like, this person approachable and things like that. And we got in touch with the public relations office at the Department of Justice. And sure enough, we were able to schedule to have Yiting come with us today. So before I bring her up, just a little bit about what she does. She is a U.S., United States, assistant attorney, and she co-chairs a multidisciplinary task force called a WASH Act. It stands for Washington Advisory Committee on Trafficking. And their mission basically is to ensure that trafficking victims just receive all the resources from the government and non-government offices together. So it's a collaborative group of government people, law enforcement, and non-government as well. And so to ensure that trafficking victims get the resources available, and also that human traffickers are prosecuted, folks, under the law. She also served on the board of Asian Pacific Islander Women and Family Safety Center. It's a nonprofit, again, that provides services to survivors of human trafficking, domestic violence, and sexual assault. And so she's been working for the Department of Justice as a prosecutor there since 1995. She also has two children, teenage children, 16 and 13, correct? Yes. All right, so we're just going to have a conversation here today. So let's all welcome Yiting to SCAC.
Good morning.
You could face me. So we're just going to kind of pretend in a way that we're just here by ourselves, you know,
okay.
And that
how much closer
no one,
should I get?
Yeah.
Angel's here, so I have to be careful.
And that no one's listening in, and so we just want to have, you know, a conversation. So first of all, thank you so much for being here. And with all you do, probably the first question is like, you know, when do you sleep? You know, I mean,
I did sleep last night.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah,
good to know.
So because I had to be alert for you this morning.
Thanks. We appreciate that. Well, before we talk about, you know, the nitty-gritty of what you do and how things are here in Seattle, I just want to know more about you, like where you grew up, where you're from, things like that.
Yeah. So my dad immigrated here to attend graduate school the year before I was born, which was a long time ago. I'm not going to tell you that right now in front of everyone.
Okay.
And he attended the University of Washington. And then my mother and my older sister joined him about a year later. And as you can imagine, that was a joyful reunion because I was born 9 months later.
Uh-huh.
And
wow.
And so I was born and raised in Seattle. And my family did live in California when I was younger for a couple of years. And then 1 year we spent actually living in Hong Kong and Taiwan, but I was very young then. And then we came back.
What year in Hong Kong, is that what you said?
Right. And then came back to Seattle, and I was raised in Seattle, went to school here.
What high school did you go to?
I went to Nathan Hale High School. Are there any alum? Oh, sorry.
That was quick.
Woo.
I think we're like Garfield people.
Yeah, there. Okay. Yeah, my daughter goes to Garfield. Are there any Garfield? Okay, all right. Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Now they love you.
Yeah,
now we're good. Now we're good. Yeah.
And I went to Seattle Pacific University for my four-year degree. And then I went to law school, and I have a master's in social work as well. From Washington University in St. Louis, and then I returned to practice law. With my social work background, I decided to do volunteer work, which is why I've volunteered at API Safety Center as a board member.
Yeah. So with this a little bit, I mean, you had the social work track and then the law track.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get interested in that particular track? Why is that important to you?
Yeah, okay. So when I was in college, I did a work study at the King County Prosecutor's Office, and they actually had assigned me to the Victim Witness Unit. And it was there that I started doing more work around working with victims of crime. And that got me really interested in law as a prosecutor. And I thought that was just a perfect kind of segue of combining both working for the rights of the oppressed and people who are victimized and traumatized, as well as advancing justice. And so that was just my way of thinking, hey, what a great, you know, combination of getting a degree in law as well as a master's in social work. And then also when I was in college, I volunteered at an agency that no longer exists. It's called Seattle Rape Relief. And I was an advocate there where I handled, like, the crisis line, you know. And so that got me interested also, particularly with respect to protecting the rights of women and children who have been harmed physically and sexually. And so that dates a long, you know, long ways back. And then when I was in law school, I decided to volunteer for a domestic violence shelter. So I did domestic violence work as well. And then coming back, kind of just wanting to be back in the community and doing a lot of volunteer work. I'm a huge, huge supporter of doing volunteer work. I always feel like I would rather sacrifice, you know, not get 2 hours of sleep and spend time 2 hours volunteering somewhere.
Amen. Yeah,
yeah.
I think that resonates with our group as well.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So it sounds like a social work kind of track first, and then you had that opportunity for the internship there.
Yes.
And then you saw how those two kind of went together, the
yes.
law and the social services, and how that all fit together. Kind
right.
of the light went on.
Yeah, and I actually started researching, like, how could I get a joint degree?
That wasn't me.
I don't think it was me either. And so I was trying to figure out, like, how do I combine the two, you know? And I found a...
Is it this?
Maybe it's this side. Let's see. Use that?
Is this better? Is it on?
Yeah, we're good. All
right. Now I feel like I'm a star.
You are today. You are today, definitely.
So I started researching universities that offered a joint degree, and Washington University in St. Louis was actually one of the few schools that that offered the joint degree. So I thought, I'll move to the Midwest, and that was a culture shock, having lived in Seattle.
Yes. Now you're Chinese. Are you? You speak Mandarin or Cantonese?
Cantonese, yeah. And I'm full Chinese.
Uh-huh.
My father is from Hong Kong, and my mother is from Guangzhou. And So I do understand Cantonese. I speak a little bit of it, but
say
I don't.
Say something to our group in Cantonese. We just want to know how good it is.
我名系胡怡婷，你好吗？Joseon.
Joseon. That's all I know, Joseon. That's all I know, too. Actually, when I first started coming to SAC, because I'm Taiwanese, when they started saying Joseon, I thought that meant pastor.
Oh.
I thought they were calling, pastor, hi, pastor. Okay. Anyway, now, were your parents Christians? Tell us a little bit about your faith journey as well.
My parents... They went back and forth between being Buddhists and Christians, And which is actually how I got started going to church, because they were in the Christian phase when they took me to a church. And for me, I found a community in church when I was younger, and so I started attending myself when my family kind of moved, or my parents moved back towards Buddhism. And a really fortunate thing was that I met my best friend when I was in seventh grade, and she started taking me to her church. And that was a real wonderful journey for me, because that was what got me kind of just kept going. I got involved in youth group, and it was a Lutheran church, and that led me to decide to go to Seattle Pacific University, because I wanted to go to a Christian church. But as you know, with Chinese parents, they don't want you to leave them, so I had to stay close. And so that was, it was great for me, because I was surrounded in a Christian community. And then when I went off to law school, I just found my own community with a Lutheran youth group there as well. And it has just, you know, grown into having some really wonderful, long-lasting friendships with very good friends.
Awesome. Yeah. What did your parents think about you going into social work? I mean, that was your first degree at SPU.
Yes, yes. I think especially with Chinese immigrant parents, it was a little tough for them, because they didn't really understand. You know, they would say, well, the government provides, you know, services. They have agencies that help. Like, why do you...
It's okay. Well, all those people you're talking about, they're the second service.
Yeah,
we're pretty safe
here. It's like, why do you do something that you don't get paid for? And, you know, so to some degree, I mean, my father actually, to his credit, he did some work in terms of, like, translation for elderly, you know, so he would do some of that stuff. But I think they wanted to see a personal purpose come out of it. Like, is this going to lead you to a job? Is this going to give you some benefit? Like, what do you see?
Yes. Yeah.
And so that, I think, was a little difficult to overcome. But in the end, when I could connect it with what I was doing with law, you know, and that's my paying job, that they had a better understanding about that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they were okay with, what about when you said, hey, I want to go work for the government?
That was fine. I mean, of course, it's their main thing was, well, you know, you could make more money in the private sector.
Right.
And so I actually did work in a firm. So I did, I worked at the King County Prosecutor's Office for a couple of years, and then I did move into working for a firm for a year before I moved on to the U.S. Attorney's Office. But I think for them, particularly moving to the U.S. Attorney's Office, working for the Department of Justice, you know, working with the United States government, was
they could be proud.
Yeah, they could be proud, exactly. Like, my daughter is a federal prosecutor. She works for, you know, the United States Department of Justice. And so that, I think, kind of overcame any concern about you're not making any more money.
right. Okay. Wow. So let's talk a little bit now just about, you know, human trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe if you could just define for our church a little bit, what is human trafficking?
Of course, there's a legal definition for human trafficking, but really the basic aspect of human trafficking is forcing someone to work against their will, okay? And when I've talked about human trafficking kind of in a, you know, like with law enforcement folks or social service providers, I try to explain that it is different in many respects than what the media portrays. You know, the media portrays that there has to be some movement across, like, state lines or borders, but there's not. I mean, you can have trafficking in right here, you know, in two blocks away, where somebody is working as a servant against their will and not getting paid the wages that they should be paid. So the core of human trafficking is the work itself. And
work, so you mean like any type of labor.
And there's, you know, the media puts a lot of emphasis on sex trafficking,
right,
and prostitution, and it's unfortunate because, yes, that's a very serious problem, but there is a lot of non-sex related labor that is out there that is actually harder to find. I've handled a lot of cases involving, you know, domestic workers or workers within the construction business or out in the
farms, and these are people who many times, not always, are recruited from another country. And they come to the United States believing that they're going to have a good job, a good paying job, and a place to stay. And they find themselves in really horrific situations. I'll just give you an example of a person. So I had a case involving a man who was from Mexico, and he supports, you know, six kids. His wife in Mexico has really hardly any income, and he entered the country illegally, meaning he didn't have permission to come into the country. He was smuggled into the country, but he thought he was going to be working for a carpet laying business, you know, learning a trade,
right.
Okay? And when he arrived, his employer told him, well, you owe me money because I helped smuggle you into the country, and so now you owe me $5,000. And on top of that, you know, you are illegal here, so therefore you're going to have to do everything I tell you to do. And he worked this man like 18 hours a day and hardly paid him any money at all. He had the man sleeping in his warehouse on a piece of carpet. The man had no bathroom facilities, had no cooking facilities. You know, when the police found him, he showed them the place where he slept, and it was literally a closet on a piece of carpet, and he had nothing. And he was very weak when they recovered him. And the reason why he even was recovered in the first place is because his employer's neighbor happened to see him working in the yard of the employer and noticing, wow, this man is weak and he doesn't speak English, and every time I try to get his attention, he looks over his shoulder as though he's scared of something. So one day the neighbor said, well, why don't I take you to a clinic? Like, just using hand gestures, like, oh, isn't your leg hurt? And the worker agreed to go, and the neighbor took him to a clinic. Unfortunately, there was a Spanish speaker at the clinic, and the story came out. And it just so happened that the neighbor had seen a PBS special the night before on human trafficking. And that what sparked his interest, you know. He's like, this looks so much like human trafficking, I want to help. And that's how the man got rescued. That's how the worker was able to get out of his trafficking situation. And now, you know, his employer has been prosecuted for trafficking. His employer had to pay him for all the wages that he didn't pay him for. Because one thing that we try to impress upon people, particularly immigrants and foreign nationals come to the country, that even if you have illegal status, the United States requires that you are to be paid under the laws of the United States. Okay. So if you're working, even if you're illegal in that sense, you still have rights. Exactly. And so that's one of the things that we try to educate and make people aware of, is you can't violate someone's rights just because they don't have legal status in the United States. You know, and that's really important, because I think a lot of people don't know that. They don't understand that. And so they end up mistreating people as a result of it.
What are some other forms of, so you're right, I think that we hear sex trafficking. That is the thing that you hear about all the
time.
But the labor trafficking is you're saying, a bigger component. It seems to be a...
It's equally as important.
Right.
And sometimes even harder, because you don't see it. It's not obvious.
Yeah, what other forms does that take besides the, like the person from Mexico? What other forms of labor trafficking?
Well, one form is we see a lot of domestic servants. Someone who's brought over from another country to work in the home. Okay, as a household servant, as a nanny, we've had a number of those cases, and they tend to be women more than men, and they tend to come from their employer's own country, which makes it even, you know, a little bit more hard to understand, because in one common country that is involved is the Philippines, because in the Philippines, it's very common to have a servant working in your home. And not necessarily common that they're mistreated, but it's just part of their culture. You know, they have a servant, okay? And I recently, actually, just a couple years ago, not that long ago, I was working, I went to Taiwan as a legal advisor on human trafficking for a few months. And it's also very common in Taiwan to have a servant working in your home, particularly if you're wealthier. And what happens is the people in the United States who come from the Philippines, because it is part of their culture to have a servant, they recruit someone from their own country to come over and to work as a servant in their home. But again, what they don't realize is even if that person comes over and works in the United States, they're entitled to be paid wages under United States law, okay? So many times they're just taken advantage of. They're vulnerable. And the people are told, well, you know, you have to work in the home for long hours. You don't have a place really of your own. You don't have a life of your own, and you're not paid very well. And many times they're threatened with deportation. They're told, well, if you don't work all the hours, like all the household work, taking care of the children, doing all the laundry and cooking and not getting any breaks.
How old would these people be?
They could be anywhere in their 20s to, we had a woman in her 50s, okay. You know, so there's not like one typical age,
yeah.
You know, it's really people who are, they're looking for an opportunity outside their home country to better their life without realizing that they can get tricked and defrauded and deceived into doing something that they don't want to do.
Yeah.
And once they come to the United States, they feel stuck,
mm-hmm.
You know, because they may not know the language, they may not know the geography of where they are. And I think I mentioned this to you when we met last week. The one place they always get to go, though, usually, is to go to church with the family.
Hmm.
And that's the one thing to look for, you know?
Uh-huh.
That's the one time they get to leave the house, is
okay.
They get to leave the house with the family to go to church. And we've talked to church members who've said, oh, yeah, you know, the family brought their... You know, they brought their auntie,
yeah.
Right? They brought
yeah.
their auntie,
yeah.
But we never talked to her, and she never said anything to us, and she was always very quiet. She was always with the children. And you're not going to see anything obvious. And, you know, out in the open, they're not going to be mistreated. But what I encourage when I've talked to other churches is get to know the person. Like, don't assume that it's none of your business, especially in a church community. We are, as a community, we want to know, who is it that we're worshiping with? Where did they come from? And there might be little telltale signs, like why isn't this person, you know, sitting with the family? Why are they sitting apart from the family? You know, why don't they go to the coffee hour afterwards? Why are they told to sit in the car, you know, to wait for
sure.
them? Just little things like that, I think that can kind of perk people's interest and get them involved.
Yeah. Let's transition to sex trafficking a
yeah.
little bit, too. I think the first time I... knew that it was kind of hitting home a bit was maybe about 5 or 6 years ago in like the Beacon Hill News I was reading.
Mm-hmm.
There was a brothel that they busted up right up here in Beacon Hill. So is this an issue that's a South Seattle issue? What's going on here in Seattle?
Okay.
In
okay.
That aspect, yeah.
I wouldn't say it's limited to South Seattle. I've had a number of brothel cases that are just all over Pierce, King, Snohomish counties. There are two kind of general categories when it comes to sex trafficking that's not what we think of as kind of typical prostitution with a pimp, okay? There are what we call residential brothels, which is what you're talking about, where they are homes that are rented, homes or apartments or condos that are rented, and or leased and or owned, and they advertise in newspapers or on the internet, and you just call a phone number, and you know generally they're men, so I'm going to be kind of general about this. Men calling up and saying, you know, where do I go to meet a person to have sex in exchange for money? Okay, and so those are residential brothels, and then there are businesses that we consider to be fronts for brothels. So generally they turn to be massage businesses. And they are located all over. I mean, we know that there are legitimate massage places, and then there are massage places that also offer sex. And they had a big raid, I think, earlier this year in Kirkland, where they shut down a number of massage places, businesses. That's happened also up in Linwood. They did a big bust of places down in Pierce County and Thurston County. So, you know, the law enforcement really pays attention to that, and they go in and they try to uncover businesses that are offering sex. And somewhat sadly is many of the businesses happen to be Chinese-owned.
You know, so it gives a bad reputation for like legitimate Chinese-owned businesses that are offering legitimate massage versus those that are trying to make some extra money by also offering sex services as well.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. I remember I shared it before. Walking down to Burger King from dropping off my rental car, and there's a foot massage place, uh-huh. Asian foot massage place that's right there. And I was looking at the door, and they had a big sign on there that says, "We don't do anything weird here. Don't even ask." You know, so because it had been so much in the newspaper all of these, and it wasn't just a South Seattle thing; it was like in Bellevue. Massage parlors and things like that.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell us a little bit about the women that? Are
being trafficked.
That are being trafficked, and where they're from, and then what happens to them?
Mm.
I think that's a big, in my heart, you know, what mm-hmm. happens to these
mm-hmm.
women
afterwards. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The women who are trafficked, you know, it's very shameful for them. I mean, regardless of whether you are trafficked in the sex industry or in some other form of work, I mean, to admit that someone has deceived or defrauded you or forced you into doing something, I think we all have a sufficient ego in us to think that we wouldn't allow that to happen. But so many times when people find out that they have been subjected to harm, that they have some self-responsibility. They feel like, oh, I could have gotten myself out of the situation. Why didn't I get myself out of the situation? When, in fact, they couldn't have because of just the surrounding circumstances. So there's a lot of shame and a lot of guilt, and I think initially even an inability to admit that anything bad happened to them because they feel that they brought it upon themselves.
Wow.
Okay. And I also think...
Is that why they don't...
Self-report, maybe?
Yeah,
or?
Why don't they run away? Why don't
yes.
they, you know...
Yes, exactly. So one aspect that sometimes I like to bring up is what's called the Stockholm Syndrome, okay? So if you know anything about the Stockholm Syndrome, it's where someone who has been, who actually feels loyalty to their captor, okay? They develop some loyalty, like their captor has been able to convince them that no one cares about them, no one else could, even if they mistreat them, that they deserved that mistreatment.
Mm.
So there's going to be a mix of sometimes they're nice to them and sometimes they're really evil to them. And it's those few little times that they're nice to them, they say, well, remember when I gave you food the other day? Or remember when I let you go outside the home for 5 minutes? And it's almost like a way of brainwashing them.
So obviously they know this, the bad guys.
Yeah,
they
have,
that,
it's a, exactly,
right?
It's a way of manipulating them and taking advantage of their vulnerabilities, right?
Yeah.
And so when the women are rescued, when they are able to be removed, there is a lot of really therapeutic work that they need to go through. And, you know, some of them agree to go to counseling and others don't. But it's a process that they have to work through in terms of even admitting to themselves that they were victimized. And many trafficking victims, in fact, most of them, don't ever self-identify as victims, okay? And it takes them some time to admit that, yes, I was a victim of a crime. Because it's not obvious. It's not like you're walking down the street and somebody comes over and robs you where you know you were a victim of a crime.
Yeah.
Okay. There's just a lot of emotional and mental manipulation that is involved in that whole kind of scenario of trafficking. And so fortunately, the U.S. government has actually had some money to give grants to social service organizations to provide services. So once we identify someone as a trafficking victim, again, they don't have to self-identify. We will interview them and determine that they were a trafficking victim. They are automatically eligible for these services. And these services will come in the form of, you know, housing and food and referral for counseling and medical care and dental care. So
wow.
It's a whole kind of cumulative effect that we can extend to them. In terms of, and many times people will say, well, what about their legal status? Because you assume, well, if they don't have legal status, they're going to get deported,
right.
And how is that going to be helpful to them? So back in 2000, when what's called the Trafficking Victims Protection Act was passed by the U.S. government, it actually extended a form of a visa that's called a T visa
that allows people to apply for status in the United States as a victim of trafficking.
Wow.
So if you are determined to be a victim of trafficking, I mean, it's not, you know, it's not like you're automatically given this status. You have to apply for it. You have to prove to the U.S. government that you were a victim of trafficking.
Sure.
But there is a remedy for them so that they can get legal status.
Gives them protection.
Exactly. Yeah. Gives them protection.
Yeah.
Gives them the ability, if they choose to stay in the United States. And it also gives them the ability to bring over family members to join them.
Wow.
In the future. So in that respect, I think, you know, the U.S. has gone to greater lengths to
Absolutely.
Be able to give protections.
Yeah.
So we try to tell folks, you know, because I think it's very scary for foreign nationals, like, well, you know, they're going to deport me, they're going to put me in prison because I'm not legal. So we're trying to raise awareness around the fact that there are, there is immigration relief that's available to them that we can explore and assist them with.
And do most people who traffic, do they... And once they are rescued, do they? Would you say the majority of them go through these programs, or do some of them kind of?
If they're identified, I would say almost all of them do. Yeah, the hard thing is identifying them. The hard thing is finding them. But once they're identified, you know, so long as we have law enforcement and social service organizations that know who to refer them to, which agencies to refer them to, they will always get services.
Okay, and that's a big thing that you do with WASH Act and WARN.
Exactly.
That a big piece of,
Yeah. So WASH Act is the, as you said, the Washington Advisory Committee on Trafficking, and it's a multidisciplinary task force. So we collaborate with federal, state, and local law enforcement on investigating and prosecuting human trafficking crimes. We also collaborate with a number of different social service organizations and community groups in raising awareness and education around trafficking, and also in letting folks know that there are services available, just as I said, like housing, you know, food, just like basic necessities that we all take for granted, that we don't realize how hard it is for a person who has nowhere to go and has no assets and has no resources to be able to provide those services to them.
When it comes to the people who are trafficking victims, trafficking people, is it in Seattle? Is it mostly, you know, the local pimps, so to speak, or is there an organized kind of crime effort here?
It's less organized. It's mostly in terms of sex trafficking. It's going to be the pimps. Who are generally men, although not always. I've had women pimps, believe it or not, who are recruiting, you know, women and sometimes, well, women and girls and sometimes men and boys to engage in sex and forcing them to engage in sex for a fee. And then there are also these massage parlors, you know, residential parlors and massage parlors. They tend, to them, it's taking advantage of another person to make money. So they don't necessarily have to do the work themselves. You know, that's kind of how I see it. It's always greed. It's always financial motive. And it's that whole ability to control another person for their own personal benefit.
So when you're in court and you see the person at the other desk, right?
The defendant.
The defendant.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Have you seen some people that are just really evil?
Oh,
like,
yes.
Just like makes your... Makes you shiver, you know, kind of.
Yeah. I had a case a few years ago who was a pimp and very violent, violent man. And the woman who he had recruited, she was 16 when he recruited her to work for him as a prostitute. And we had pictures of her after he had beaten her. He had crushed her eye socket. He had broken her ribs. You know, she has, he crushed her jaw. She still has lingering injuries from that, where her eye doesn't close all the way now, you know, where she's lost teeth and had to get them replaced. And he had made her crawl against a kind of along a gravel driveway while after he had beaten her, and she was just bloody. I think, an evil person. And, you know, laughed at her, had put cigarettes out on her, and she had injuries from that. So we could, you know, we ended up showing the jury, and it's just a horrific scene to be able to see pictures like that. And what I think is what's hard is this is a woman who is subjected to a lot of beatings and a lot of assaults by this man, and yet she can, you know, she didn't, quote unquote, leave him. Okay. So, I mean, I it's hard because you wonder, like, how, and when you think about domestic violence, you think about women who are in relationships, and not just women, but men who are in relationships as well, who are being abused by their partner and why they don't leave. And there's a whole psychology around that, which, you know, we'd have to have another Sunday morning interview about that. But I considered him to be very evil. And even while the woman was testifying, right in front of the jury, he went like this to her, okay, as a warning to her about testifying against him. Yeah, and so somebody like that just has, I think, has is like a sociopath. Oh, yeah, he's serving 26 years in federal prison.
All right, awesome. Wow, awesome. Another question, how does this, with your faith, in interacting with what you do, we talk a lot here about careers and your faith intersecting and things like that. This must be a pretty big thing, God, knowing, understanding God as a God of love and God of grace, a God of justice, and then you're kind of doing the work of justice, you know, as well. I don't know, how does that feel as you're living your faith out and doing this kind of work?
I would say it's, as you can all imagine, it can be really a struggle. Sometimes when you see how people are hurt and what they've been through, and especially people who have faith, you know, for them, it's so hard to understand why they feel as though God has abandoned them. And so it makes me think about, well, has God really abandoned them? And it's really a challenge, and it's really a struggle. And I think for me, I have felt that if I can just be one piece of bringing, of healing for them, then that's how God is working through me.
Amen.
And it's hard because we all want to take care of each other's problems, right? We want to understand everything, and we can't. And so I have tried to resolve in myself that I can only do what I can do and add my piece to it. And if that means helping one person at a time, I will help one person at a time and do the best job that I can. But I can't predict the outcome, and I have to hope that God has a plan in the future.
Yeah.
And sometimes things don't go the way that I want them to go. But I have to have faith that there's a plan out there, right? I mean, that's what faith is about, and that's what hope is about.
Yeah.
And sometimes I will see things that immediately don't seem right. Like, I see people who are continually struggling, even after they've been rescued, but they can't get a job. And so then they, you know, they just are continuing to struggle. But then a year later, they said, hey, I went through that struggle, and now I realize it's all for the better. But while they're going through the struggle, it's hard for me to see, okay, where is God in their life? And that's patience, and it's faith. And now that I'm older, I have a better understanding of what that really means and how it applies to us.
Yeah. So, running a little short on time, big question for us is, what can a church do?
That's a really big question. That's a really big question. My suggestion is not reinventing the wheel, okay? And so I think it's important to, as a church, to think about what are your priorities. You know, once you understand what the issue is and what the needs are locally. A lot of churches do a lot of support internationally, which I think is fantastic. But I also think that there is an immediate need locally, and that if you can focus an immediate need locally, identify what that need is and what you're willing to do. And my suggestion is to connect with a local organization that provides services to human trafficking victims and talk to them and say, what can we do to assist you? And don't reinvent the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be that they may need, hey, we need housing vouchers, you know, we need hotel vouchers, okay? Or we need food cards to give to our human trafficking survivors. Or we need a bus card. Or we need, one of the organizations that I work with, they put together care packages. And so the care package is a laundry basket with a sleeping bag, some toiletry items, you know, a little gift card to Fred Meyer for $50 or whatever so that they can buy food. I mean, ask the organizations, what do you need? And then get your community together to put those items together to give to them. And remain connected. Because a lot of times what we have found is, like, somebody will, a church will say, okay, we're going to help you one time, and then they move on to the next thing,
right.
You know, and you lose that connection. I think it's important to develop that long-term connection. And as I've told you before that there are organizations out there I'm happy to connect you to, and, you know, you can almost do an interview with each of them and say, okay, let's talk to each of them and see which one our community may have the best connection with, either regionally or philosophically or spiritually, however that you feel that might best fit your community.
Great, thank you. Great words for us.
Okay,
we're going to close up our interview time together. And before we do that, I really wanted